Hello and welcome to TDF Talks. I'm Lucy Fagans, and this is a fortnightly podcast from The Design Files, Australia's most popular design blog. In this podcast, we chat to leading Australian creatives of all kinds. This is episode 39. Thank you so much for tuning in. Just a reminder too that this is an enhanced podcast, which means it has pictures. If you listen using Overcast, Pocket Casts, or the latest version of the Apple Podcast app, then you'll see images and links on your phone screen whilst you listen. Claire Bowditch is an ARIA award-winning singer-songwriter, an actress, a storyteller, and a mother of three. And this month, she's added author to that impressive list of credentials. I first met Claire many years ago, actually through my husband, Gordy, who knew Claire in a previous lifetime when the two of them worked together at Surf, Dive and Ski in the 90s. I bet you didn't think you'd hear that on this podcast. Anyway, over the past 10 years, I've watched Claire's career continue to rise, and also I've seen the way she's been able to adapt and really turn her hand to so many different creative outlets. It seems there's pretty much nothing that she isn't good at. She was already a famous singer when I first met her, but in the last decade, she's turned her hand to acting, winning a Logie for her role on Offspring. She's presented ABC Radio, she's hosted workshops and events for creative people, and now, of course, she's finally released her first book. The book is called Your Own Kind of Girl, and whilst it's a memoir of sorts, Claire explains that most of the events in the book occur before her musical career really took off. In typical Claire fashion, the book is achingly real, full of heart, and so very generous. And it's really been written to share Claire's lifetime of learnings about self-doubt and anxiety and coming through the other side. Claire has always been the most radiant, glowing human. She's a deep connector and has an uncanny knack for making you feel like the center of the universe when she's speaking to you. I very much hope that some of that magic comes through in this podcast. Hello and welcome to TDF Talks. Today I'm catching up with ARIA award-winning singer-songwriter, Logie-nominated actress, radio host, many other things, and now also published author, Claire Bowditch.
Oh my gosh, it's like a dream come true to be here. I love it.
You're so kind. Thank you so much for being on our podcast in what is possibly the busiest week of your life. You're about to go on a national tour with your new book, but I'm so grateful to have a moment to sit down and chat with you.
Me too.
So, Claire, when I was preparing for this interview, I was like, it is so hard to succinctly describe everything you do and everything you've done. You know, as I mentioned, you're a singer-songwriter and you've done so many things, but I guess the singing and the music is probably what you're best known for. And before we get into everything else, I would really love to chat a little about, I guess, your early life. So just where you grew up and what led you to a career in music.
Thanks, Lise. I often get confused too about how to describe what it is that I do or why I do it. But I think I've had a realization recently that the thing that drives me in all of the adventures that I've had is I really like to have fun. I really like pleasure. I really like humans. I love connecting with them. And I'm also slightly obsessed with making meaning and making the most of life and making things matter. And so when I look back to, so why is this? You know, why are these things, why do these things motivate me? And what is this restlessness that's been there all of my life? All I have to do is really just turn it all the way back to growing up in Sandringham, the youngest of five. My mother was from Holland, from Amsterdam. She came here just she wanted a little holiday. She said to her dad, she's like, Mum was one of 11 born in post-war Amsterdam. She said to her dad in the 60s, I would like to go to Paris. She said it in Dutch. And her father said, no, Paris is for wild women. You know, you must go to Australia, to Clayton, to hang out with your sister who'd migrated here.
Obvious choice.
So Mum got on the long, long journey and ended up here. She could barely speak English, and she taught herself to speak English in the state library at lunchtime. She was working in the basement at Myers, and she taught herself to speak English in that dome room by reading the novels of Virginia Woolf and copying that speech. She's always had a beautiful way with words. That's perhaps why. And she met my father, Ian. They fell in love, and they were both sort of They had a similar faith and a similar value structure. So they'd both been brought up Catholic, and Catholic, you know, in terms of their values. And, you know, they were friends, and then they made a match at Walter's Wine Bar down in Carlton. They had their engagement and off they went. So we were brought up in this home where, you know, as I said, I was the youngest of five. We were all born 18 months apart, and we had a dog, and my parents were building their first home in Sandringham, which was a sort of almost Swedish style of home. And we were a pretty normal family pottering along. We loved to sing. We loved making tapes for my Holland relatives, my Oma and Opa. And we would sing on the tapes, and there wasn't TV, and it was a safe little neighbourhood in a cul-de-sac. And I think we probably would have just potted along as a pretty normal family, except that when I was three and my sister older than me, Roey, was five, she became really ill. And we didn't know why. And my parents and our family was then kind of spiraled into trying to hold together normality with this incredible panic about what's wrong with Roey, you know, and she would get well and then get unwell again. And she had problems with sight, with dehydration. She had to be admitted to hospital a few times. And finally, 6 months into that, they discovered she actually had a terminal illness and a very unusual illness, a little like MS. And she was admitted to the Children's Hospital where she lived for 2 years, which was much longer than they thought she'd live. And she was on life support and she was a quadriplegic. But she was, you know, my earliest memories are none of these things. I just knew that my big sister, Roey, who was still the boss, was in hospital. So we had all of, you know, our life really then became a family life that was structured around trying to make sense of what was going on and enjoying our time together. And somewhere in that complex soup, this is probably quite a long answer, but I think it's really important that somewhere in that complex soup, making tapes for Roey, singing into the tapes so she could play them, the nurses could play them overnight for her, that was a really big part of our identity then. Our identity started to form around, if mine did, around pressing play and record on a tape recorder and making songs and lifting people's spirits and keeping things light, and also knowing that there was something really intense and tragic and painful going on in between all this love and all this community, all of these people bringing meals and, you know, my parents' faith, the prayers and the love and laughter that went on as well. So that, you know, I don't often tell that story, but I've started to recently because I just feel like it really does inform everything that I've done or am continuing to try to do with my creative life and with the community work that I do, and now with this new book that I've written.
Whoa, that, yeah, you're right. That is an amazingly in-depth answer. Thank you so much for sharing.
I'm just going to take a sip of this this liquid here because I'm like, oh God.
For the benefit of the tape, we're sitting in the Design Files storeroom because it has the best acoustics in my building, and we're here on a Saturday, so we've poured ourselves a glass of wine.
And it's a special Saturday because it's actually Lucy's birthday, guys. It's actually Lucy's birthday.
That's true.
Happy birthday to you. Happy birthday to you. Happy birthday to Lucy. Happy birthday to you.
Yippee. Well, thank you.
I just had to embarrass you with that. I'm sorry.
Thank you, Claire. Yes, it's an unusual day, but we're together and we're celebrating somewhat
yes,
in the storeroom.
We are.
But at least we have a glass of wine.
We certainly do. And water too, just so you know. We're actually keeping fully hydrated. Although if either of us did need to go to the bathroom at any point, it would be quite the struggle because this is, I just got to tell you, it's so exciting to be here in the heart center of Design Files, the TDF. That's where it all happens. I'm surrounded by sound equipment and bottles of champagne and, you know, wine glasses and files. It's very exciting. And paint.
Yeah, well, yeah, we really are right in the thick of it.
I love it.
So, you know, music was, I guess, your first career path, and you've done so many things since then. You know, I feel from an outsider's perspective, it seems to me that music is like a really difficult and competitive industry. And you...
That's not been my experience. I've had a breeze of a time. No.
Well, this is what I mean. Like, you have been hugely successful.
No,
and
not that successful, but thank you. No, it's lovely. But I've been successful in, I think, a good way. But, yeah, I'll let you ask your question and then I'll tell you what I think about this.
Okay. Well, yeah, I just sort of wondered, you know, it is an industry that is known for sort of chewing people up and spitting people out and, yeah, being just incredibly hard to get anywhere with. So what do you think has made it work for you?
Yes. Okay. Right. I'm going to, again, I'll just go straight into it because I'm in my 40s now. I don't, small talk is not my gift at this moment in time. I like to get to the heart of it. So it's this, right? I grew up as a woman in a body, like I was always called big when I was little. I was really tall and I was quite big and I loved to sing and I loved to make music, but I looked around me and I never saw many women who looked like me making music. I didn't see, you know, there was, we had Madonna and lots of wonderful role models, but I really did. My mother, we were lucky to be able to listen to Like a Virgin. It was, I remember that coming on and me going, "Mum, what is a virgin?" And so, you know, I was in that era where Madonna was queen. And I wondered, is there any place for a woman like me with songs like mine? I was writing songs from 3 and 5 and then 16, I was in my first band singing backups around the pubs in Fitzroy. In Collingwood, it was my brother-in-law's band at places like the Rochester Castle, the Evelyn Hotel. And all the while, I didn't realise at the time, but I actually had a really hardcore inner critic. I had a lot of survival drive in me and it made my head really noisy and I just couldn't imagine, you know, as if a girl like me could ever have a career in music. My criticism mainly centred around my weight. It didn't occur to me until much, much later that actually it doesn't really matter what you weigh in terms of creating a song or, you know, I'm not there to be a size 10 fashion model. I'm there to write songs. So getting to a place where I thought I might have half a chance at music was quite, I was quite late. You know, I dropped out of that band because I tried to record. I had a panic attack, which I didn't know was a panic attack, in the recording studio. I was working in a surf shop at the time. I was in high school and I quit the band. I just thought there's something wrong with me. I'm obviously really crap at this. And the band couldn't understand why, but they always said, all right, you know, I just told them it was because of year 12, but it's really because I thought, what chance have I got? I just didn't see anyone around me doing it the way I wanted to do it. And what I also knew was in order to make a career for yourself in the 90s and noughties, early noughties, still it was very common. The way you did it was to get a record contract. And in order to get a record contract, you have to look and be a certain way and you had to sign away some of your rights. And these things terrified me. They were just not, you know, the way I was wired. Now, fortunately, as time went on, I continued to write songs. And I found some role models. I went one day to a little music store in the middle of Melbourne called Gaslight Records. And I was very fortunate to be invited to go and see a show by a guy called Jeff Buckley. I bought his CD and they said, oh, he's coming to the store tonight. There were 40 of us in that room, maybe 50. And what I saw that night blew my mind. He was so funny and charming and insecure and brave and beautiful. And I thought, ah, you know, there's almost a jealousy, almost a sort of envy and this admiration as well. And I thought, what's that? And I realized that's because I want to do what he's doing. I want to connect with people through song. So I got slightly brave and then I started to see people around me like Jeff Buckley and like Ani DeFranco using this new model thing called the internet had been invented and we could then communicate directly with fans and you could sort of sidestep the music industry in a way or the record contracts or the people who told you how you were supposed to be. And so that was really helpful to have those role models. And then I was very fortunate to meet a couple of mates, a guy called John Hedigan, who had a housemate called Marty Brown. And they lived, I was 22. They lived a few streets down. We recorded some demos in Marty's bedroom, which was amazing because there were no gangs of kids recording in bedrooms in there in 1997, 98, 99. He just happened to be a sound engineer studying commerce. So we recorded and I kept thinking, God, he's really handsome and attractive, but we've got such a good working relationship. This is the guy I ended up marrying, but it took a while. We just worked on songs for a long time. He kind of managed us. We started a band called Red Raku. And that's really, I want to sort of go into detail there because a lot of what I had to encounter was the courage to say to John, yeah, I am a songwriter. We met by random at Comfest, a hippie festival on the Yarra. We sang together. Oh, sorry, on the Murray, not the Yarra. We sang together. It sounded really good. And he said, do you want to start a band? And every part of me wanted to say yes, but my habit had been to say no, as if, you know, and my mind would always say that guy could be a psycho or blah, 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 blah. I was always talking myself out of these adventures. This time I went, yep, I am a songwriter. And he said, show me some of your stuff. And that's how it started. So that first courageous act, even though it took me years to get stagecraft and years to get over my stage fright, that first courageous act of letting myself collaborate with another musician was hugely important. I got really serious about my music career when Marty and I were about to become parents. And then I thought, I'm going to give it a crack. And that's when we started releasing our singles and getting them played on Triple R and then later Triple J. And as the years progressed and we toured and toured and toured and learned how to live on beans and rice and then started applying for grants and gradually making money, it took about 10 years really before we went, right, this is what we do. We're going to do this to make our, we're going to make our living doing what we love.
Yeah. So amazing. And it's so interesting to hear you say that you sort of didn't really take it seriously or really throw everything at it until you knew you were going to become parents.
Yes.
Because I had a sort of similar experience too in my business where I was doing what I was doing, but it wasn't until I was pregnant that I was like, oh, you know, I really have to, it made me take a few risks, hire a few staff, get a bit more serious about it because I just knew that that was the only option. And I guess I don't know, maybe there's something there that like it, I don't know if it's the hormones or just the being scared of having that responsibility that really maybe is actually quite encouraging in some ways. And it's good for women who are going to be parents to hear that because prior to that, I'd spent my 20s thinking, how will I ever have a kid and have a creative job? And that will never work. And I need a proper job and straightforward maternity leave. And it's not, you know, so I think it's good for people to hear that actually having a kid can be exactly what you need to sort of encourage you to take a leap.
Yeah. One of the things I think that it does, if we nut down to, so why, you know, why is that, you know, do you have to have a child to get serious about your career? Well, no, but you do need a point in time where you go, actually, we're on. Like, I am going to count myself in. And that can be hard when you haven't seen role models around you do it, or when you're a front runner, your business is one of the first businesses to be doing what you were doing in the Australian market, or even, you know, internationally, really. This is a particular era in time. And the same was true for us, for Marty and I in our career. We were one of the first generation to be able to go, oh, right, so if we want to do it our own way, we can. And then the point of courage comes when you go, and I will. So what's that about? You know, that might be you need to get some idea of a bigger calling, because actually, you know, there's all these cliches about wanting to be rich and famous. It's not terribly motivating. Like, it, you know, what we don't really want rich and famous. What we want is, that's a metaphor for, we want to matter and we want to have choice. And until you can hook in with something that can draw you along that quite difficult path, it's quite a narrow little cave entrance really there, and you've got to stick in the dark for a really long time in almost all creative endeavor and business. You have to have a reason why that matters. And for me, it started to matter because I was going to have a child and I wanted to set an example in the world about what it looks like to actually live your dream. And I was very fortunate that my partner was on the same track. I know for many people listening, they feel quite alone in their desire to live their dreams, and they think, what, you know, what's the point of it? And I'll never do it. And you can easily count yourself out. The trick is to really name that inner critic and put it to the curb. You know, do it for me, do it for Lucy, do it for someone that you love. Do it, like, if you need that inspiration, you know, you don't have to tell anyone, but you've got a bigger picture that can draw you forward through the difficult bits.
So it's so interesting. And it's, yeah, we have had such different, completely different career paths, but it's interesting that actually everything you're saying is so true of, as you said, anyone who's sort of, yeah, running their own race.
Well, I think there's something similar about the way that we've done things. So we both, you know, we live in Melbourne and our businesses are built in Melbourne and based here. But I think what we've both attempted to do is to build businesses that are quite close to our values and that contribute something potentially beautiful or useful. And, you know, I'm like a sad rock of sax compared with the design files. You know, you
look, no.
But do you know what I mean? Like, I write songs sometimes about sad things and sometimes about happy things. But with the design files, I think you've always been really clear in what you wanted to contribute. And that, again, can be a really excellent driving force. We're two women who have built our own businesses and we've tried to do that now with family. And I think that's why I feel so lucky to have this conversation. To be, when I listen to this podcast and when I listen to other people, I'm like, oh, right, okay, thank you, because it inspires me to hear that true story.
Yeah,
totally. I don't want to hear it's easy. I want to hear that it's possible.
Yeah.
And I want to hear that the hard work is worth something.
Yeah.
And I want to be reminded that actually none of it's worth anything unless you're making art or making craft or making business that matters to you and that is good.
Yeah.
You do have to work on that side of it. But all the other business stuff you'll work out.
Yeah. You are so wise. Every time I meet you with you, I just feel like you're just so – you're like supernatural. You are. You're just so wise and it comes from a place of such like – I don't know. You've got an aura about you. I've always – yeah, you're amazing. Anyway,
you're hilarious. You're gorgeous.
No, you are. My
address that Christopher gave me, he's so beautiful. He gave me a crystal yesterday and I don't have many crystals in my life and it was like a clear crystal and he said, carry this with you. And I thought, I need more sort of talismans like that, like little things that I can just pull out. and look at and then go, ah, I'm connected to a higher source. You know? Do you have those things? Do you have
I'm not very spiritual about stuff like that. But I just think that that's just a metaphor for your own inner strength. You know, it's just whatever it takes for you to sort of, I don't know, connect with that. I'm not a crystal person.
I must admit, tapped the power of crystals very difficult, very hard myself. But it was so beautiful that I had and this again is back to this point, I had a friend in my life. This is Christopher, who's my hairdresser. We never see each other socially. But he knew a big thing was coming up for me and he knew I'd be nervous about it, which was this book tour. And he gave me a little something that made me feel safe. And I think, you know, again, back to if your partner or the people in your life, your parents or your kids even aren't supportive of your creative dream, it's okay, but it's not their creative dream, it's yours. So you do need to find people who, you know, who are in that same boat with you and in that same arena with you.
Yeah. And then you did touch on Marty, your husband, and your manager and collaborator in all things. I'm sure you ask this question a lot, but I'll ask it anyway.
Go on.
How do you make it work? I'm sure a lot of people say, I could never work with my husband. How do you do it? Like, what have you learned about, you know, how you make that work?
Well, I think sex is really important, Liz. I think Tuesdays and Fridays, I'm joking, guys. We had twins. There was a long dry patch there, let me tell you.
Poor Marty. Sorry, Marty.
No, he's going to have he's got quite a stud reputation around town because Marty has a grace about him. So let's get back to him. Here's the truth of it. Marty is a particular kind of a chap. He's very tall. The first time I saw him when he walked into that share house, he had to duck his head in the door and went and played drums. And I thought, holy bajoli, that guy's so tall. But he has this grace about him and he's highly cerebral in terms of he can manage a lot of fine details. So, and I'm not terribly that way inclined. Like, you know, a couple of days before my period, I'm cleaning like a mofo. Believe me, every crack and crevice, I'm quite Dutch in that way. But that's my level of detail, you know. With him, it's every day, it's consistent. And he always believed in my work. So he was always encouraging of my songs, even when they were half finished. And he was kind and I believed him. And that was a really important, beautiful friendship and dynamic. And we were big fans of each other. I really believed in him. He was a drummer for Art of Fighting and all these. He was a drummer for SodaStream. And I was a really big fan of all the bands that he was in as well when we were younger. So I think the basis of our relationship is a very solid friendship. And like I said before, the fact that we kind of wanted to jump each other's bones was something we tried to ignore for quite a while because it's very inconvenient when you have an excellent working relationship. They're so important. But by the time we were 26, we were done with the denial. And we got together and he's just one of the few people in the world that I kind of like being around all the time. I mean, he drives me nuts, don't get me wrong, but I can say to him, you are driving me nuts. And then he'll say something dumb and I'll just go, I've got to be away from you. Like that's sort of as bad as it gets. And it's always a little bit humorous. So we've got a playfulness about our relationship. So we have a solid working relationship that works well and he has an incredible work ethic and I do too and we complement each other's various, you know, strengths and weaknesses. But I got to say, I know that this is sounding idealistic. I got to explain, it's really not. You know, we have three children. We've had all the same financial highs and lows of everyone working who runs their own business. We've had the loss of friends and family illnesses and all these other things that we're always trying to manage in our lives together in our little business. And for a while there, we really didn't concentrate on the romance or the connection that we had. And so a couple of years back, we were making an album called The Winter I Chose Happiness. It was maybe 10 years ago. And before we made it together, because making an album together can get quite heady and I can get quite sensitive and he can get quite brutal. Neither of us mean it. But, you know, we work it out. But I was a bit worried. So we went and got some good, solid counselling. And the advice that we walked out with was basically, good on you for coming to counselling. Now you just have to go on a date every week together.
Really? That was the advice?
That was, you know, after we'd worked through a few of the communication issues and accepting each other's differences, really. You know, he's never going to be someone who needs to express his feelings in the same way that I do. And a lot of the way that he processes things is to get on with the work, whereas I might need to hide in a cave and make something, a song or a story or something to make sense of it. He's very creative too. He's got his own bands in his own way of doing things, but we accepted that about each other. And then we made the radical move to have a date night on Wednesdays. And It just helped us. And we tried to make rules at first about we're not going to talk about work when we're there and we're going to not talk about the kids. But really, these are the things that we find fascinating that anchor us and we find interesting together. And so we didn't put any rules on it for a few years. We just hung out on Wednesdays and it sort of allowed the romance and the love to creep back in. So we have some highs and we have some lows, but I still really like him and he really likes me, and I would even go so far as to say that we still love each other.
Well, you guys make the most amazing team. And
thanks, buddy.
I can attest to the fact that Marty is a very spunky man. I can say that because I feel like you think my husband's spunky, so I'm probably even.
I don't know if it, yeah, I'm a huge fan of Gordy, who is Lucy's hubby, and he's such a good, solid man. And I think there's this beautiful thing that happens when a chap is secure in himself, which is that he's able to, you know, I see with Marty and I see this too with Gordy, that they're able to really give their heart to their family, their own work, their kids, and also the dreams of the family. And, you know, you and I are both the front runners of these family dreams, but I think it's understood that I'm really just the front face of my family's dream.
Yeah.
It is a family
dream.
Even this book, you know, that was a family dream. They all knew why I wanted to do it. They were the ones, you know, my kids were really coaching me along. They'd bring me cups of tea. I'd say to them, sometimes when you're writing a book, you're just in your pajamas for quite a while. I'd be like, I'm really sorry. I've just come back home from school. I've hardly changed, you know. And I said, sorry, this looks pretty bad, doesn't it? And, you know, they understood that this is okay. It's part of the creative process.
Yeah.
We'll still get some baked beans on the table eventually.
You are prolific in so many areas. You know, we've touched on, you know, the various things you do from music to acting and radio, and you've also had many of your own events, you know, Big Hearted Business and Tea with Jam and Claire, and you just do so much. And I'm wondering if that has been a sort of, has it been a strategic decision on your part? You balk at the word strategic.
No, not at all, because I think if you were strategic, you would have done one thing well and just stuck with it. If you were clever strategically, one part of me goes, Jamila and I were having this chat the other day about how if you're good at one thing and you become really excellent at one thing and you become known for one thing and then you're the go-to person on that one thing.
Yeah.
That's just not been my experience, because I'm curious and I love humans and I want to have fun. And so I'm not terribly good at sticking around when I'm bored or restless, you know, not in terms of friendships or life, but in terms of work projects.
Yeah.
I have a very busy muse who's often very persuasive.
Yeah.
And I also have, you know, I do, and I will say this out loud now, I do have that experience of being brought up in a very big, bubbly, busy social family where there was also this trauma that we're always trying to manage. And so I'm still that as an adult, but I'm doing it now. Now my job is really about, you know, being a story baker, be helping other people tell their stories. And the way I do that, just it changes form all the time.
Yeah.
So, you know, I've lamented that often. I've thought, why can't I just do, you know, low times? And I'm like, why couldn't I just do one thing and stick to it? Because I get tired quite a lot of the time.
Yeah,
all
the different I bet you things. Do.
But it's not my way. I'll give you know, an example. I started this love project called Big Hearted Business in 2012. It was a simple idea. I was just sick of seeing all my beautiful friends who were wonderful, incredible artists give up on the art, and I was sick of seeing my mates who were in corporate environments basically want to die because they were so uncreatively fulfilled. And it wasn't a conversation that we were having much in the corporate world at the time or in the arts world. So what if we can teach creative people about business and business people about creativity in ways that make sense? Little simple idea, started with a small event. Lucy, you were one of our esteemed guest speakers, and it just snowballed and it took over our life and our creative, you know, we became then someone, an organization with staff. And really, in order to fuel that organization, I did years of public speaking. I still do quite a lot of it. It pays incredibly well and you can be incredibly useful, but I wasn't making any creative projects myself at the time. And I love that, but it's really just sits there now as we do run some events and we do still do some speaking events. But you know, I couldn't sustain that and sustain my own creative life. I didn't want to sell it. I didn't want the idea of it to be diluted. And I didn't want it to be used as a vehicle to sell other products either. It was a love project. It was turning into a business that was hard to sustain. And so I just made a call, you know, we'll simplify that model. And we did. I took a job on radio for a couple of years again, at that time, our dear friend John had been unwell with brain cancer, and we really had that wake up call in our 30s where you went, shit, life is short, let's pull in. So we did. Kids are at school. So there's sort of a logic, I guess I'm saying, in the different choices I've made. The 2 years on radio was wonderful, extraordinary, precious time.
Yeah.
You have this audience, you have this access to Melbourne, the golden key to Melbourne that is just unbelievable. And still my cup is filled up most days of the week with people who, you know, I spend afternoons with, you know, yeah. listeners.
Yeah.
But I came to a certain point where this book project wouldn't go away and the album was still being put off years after, you know, 5 years behind schedule. And it occurred to me that I couldn't stay on the interviewing side of the mic and interviewing these extraordinarily interesting people every day, you know, 26 interviews a week, without starting to fit in a single producer team. So I was starting to feel like a shriveled up version of Claire Bowditch, like the shell of a woman who once used to be, you know, Claire Bowditch.
Yeah.
And I had to make a really hard call because I was really happy there. And a lot of my colleagues stay in their stations for, you know, 10, 20 years.
Yeah.
But I realized I couldn't do that without a cost. So I let it go. I took a risk and I wrote this book instead, and I feel more myself now. So
yeah,
I miss that radio show, but I really appreciated it and I was able to leave before it got shitty feeling.
Yeah. Well, that's...
Excuse my French.
Yeah. Well, that's... No, but I feel like that is... That's wise in itself, to know when it's time to do the next thing. And
probably would have been wiser to pay off the house first. And you know what I mean? Like, there are all these financial opportunities that we've had in life where I go, that would have been a bit smarter then. But to be honest, I really wouldn't change anything.
Yeah.
Yeah, I wouldn't change that stuff. What I would change is a lot of the time wasted on self-doubt.
Yeah. You have been a pretty well-known face, dare I say, celebrity.
Are we talking about my modelling career again? I knew it. I knew this would come up. Well,
no, but, you know, you are a familiar face. You are a face that many people know in Melbourne and in Australia. And it's 20 years or more in as a sort of well-known figure is a long time. And I'm just wondering what you think has been... Well, how have you been able to stay grounded in that time to sort of maintain that? Because I think...
Oh, God. Life is so humbling. Grounded has never been an issue. My whole, you know, I'm grounded meaning, you know, there's never, even with my friends who I've seen have enormous, extraordinary smash hits internationally in film or in song, or, you know, people who we were cutting our teeth together in Melbourne, they've gone off. I've never yet seen a human being who really finds this business of being a human being easy. I just haven't found them yet. If you're that person, you should contact us here at TDF and we should study you. And, because it's I didn't really let you finish your question then, Luce, but I...
No, I like the answer I'm getting.
You know, I find this process of attempting to make your life's work mean something, there's no feeling of ever I've reached it.
Yeah.
I'm very conscious about celebrating the simple pleasures, you know, the tea and toast pleasures, or I've been thinking a lot lately about Ostro, about Julia, and the way that, you know, she helps me remember to enjoy the making of the pasta and the slow living. Those are really where I get my everyday pleasures. And they're the things that keep me grounded or keep me feeling centered or anchored to life.
Yeah.
The creative pursuits and the ambition is quite destabilizing. You know, I'm not someone who particularly likes touring. That I like touring for that 1.5 hour that I'm with you on that stage and we're in the audience together and we're making something special together. The 22 and a half hours of travel, of planning, of having to do your bloody hair and,
you know, yeah, not see your kids.
And, yeah, I don't know who enjoys. I mean, it's kind of humbling work.
Yeah.
You know, squishing on the delayed plane, and even though it's an utter privilege.
No, it looks like a slog. Like when I see you on Instagram stories and it's like, oh, you're God. What now? You're now in Perth. What now? Where? You know, it seems massive. Like it's just, it's a huge commitment to do that. And
it's almost an addictive relationship. I get such pleasure and such satisfaction from creative, you know, the process of creative making and then the connecting with humans in the world with it. But everything in between is very imperfect and always has been. And I think also I still live, and again, back to sort of where we started in a way, but I will always live with this feeling, as all children and adults who go through grief often live with this feeling, that there's more I could have done. There's something I should have done. There's this sort of sense of innate fury at our mortality and at the way we can't choose our circumstances. And I think my life's work, and again, I know I've said this so many times, but my life's work has been about trying to accept life on life's terms, circumstances, and then tell myself good stories anyway, because my mind's always, you know, rolling with worry stories about everything that could go wrong. My discipline is to say, actually, what about what could go right?
Yeah.
And what about if, you know, when I was a 21-year-old, my turning point was going, what about if in 20 years' time I was a mum and everything had worked out, and because I always wanted to be a mum, and I was making songs and I had a dog and I was in love and I was, you know, what if that happened? My experiences mean this, it did happen, you know, yeah. It did happen, but it wasn't easy to get here, and the pleasure is in enjoying those little moments.
Yeah. So now I would love to talk about the book.
I'm going to take a massive gulp of this wine. Can I just say, we've only had like a quarter of a glass of wine each.
Each going
to
take a sip.
I want to cheers to you, and I want to cheers to everyone out there who's giving it their all right now, because I love you.
Really do.
I see them, Luce.
I know
they
you
come
do.
To our events. You see them too.
I know.
Go, hit me.
So the book. This month you've released a book and it is getting so many brilliant reviews already. Tell me why you decided to write a book.
Cool. The book is called Your Own Kind of Girl, which is the title of a song that I wrote in 2008. And it's a song where I spoke for the first time about, you know, it may or may not have been fictional, I said at the time, but about this struggle that I'd always had and that I saw other beautiful women having with, you know, where do I fit in the world? Am I enough? All that usual stuff that is a virtue of having a human brain that has a lower and higher brain. Lower brain is always giving us crap every time we try and do anything that's a little bit out of line. Sometimes it's just a sign that you're onto something. But, you know, I'd had this sort of story always in my head of not belonging. And as I started singing and talking about that on stage, other women and men started telling me that that was their story too. So I wrote this song called Your Own Kind of Girl, which is about the possibility of self-determination, the possibility that you don't have to be anything more than you already are, and that we actually long for real human beings to love. We don't want you to be perfect, you know, and that was my experience. And in that I spoke a little about this secret story that I'd had, one of the ways I managed my grief and feelings as a child, combined with some pretty good genetics, survival genetics, was that my weight waxed and waned. I used to call myself the human piano accordion, and I still am, you know, in some ways. My body really often tells a story for me that I would prefer to keep secret, which is that I'm very human and, you know, I, in this particular story of 10 to 21, that I really was quite a big kid. I went on my first diet and everyone treated me differently. And that was shocking and exciting to me. So then I struggled with diets on and off, really in a very common and secretive way, until I was 21, where it all came to a head and I was forced to face that historical grief. And I was forced to ask myself, what do I want to do with my life? And it really came in the form of what can only be described as a genuine, authentic nervous breakdown, which, like Brené Brown's therapist, my therapist tried to call it a breakthrough. And I said, how the F can this be a breakthrough? This looks like me being decimated. You know, I really was very unwell. I'd gone on a trip to London and I'd become extremely unwell and I'd had to come home, and it took me a really long time just to learn how to function again. This, you know, and I was very lucky. I found a book I was given a book by one of my mum's friends called Self-Help for Your Nerves by Dr. Claire Weeks. It's this old-fashioned book, and I'm telling you, if you looked at it, I mean, any other time in my life I would have looked at it and gone, as if I'm going to read that. There's a picture of a little old lady who looks like the queen on the front. And I had this sort of – I was from indie Melbourne scene. Self-Help Your Nerves wasn't exactly the title of the book that I wanted to, you know, bet my life on. But I was that desperate and that unwell, and I'd been home now for several months from London, and I still wasn't recovering. I just didn't realize what I was suffering from was – textbook anxiety, and this book helped me frame it really well. She called it nervous suffering. She had a historical Second World War, you know, background. She was one of Australia's first females to get a doctorate at the University of Sydney, and she was a real stalwart and a real, really progressive, but she was seen as a bit of a wacko because she wasn't a psychiatrist, and who the hell did she think she was telling people how they could be cured from what she called nervous suffering? So, look, I learned her little techniques. I made them my own. I found some extra things along the way and I recovered. And I said, one day, if this recovery sticks and if I'm brave enough, I will tell this story. But not until I'm really effing old, like really old, like 40. So that was my caveat. All these years of making music and touring and mothering, I've always known that I did make this promise to myself, get a little emo thinking about it, that I would one day tell this story. And it's not, you know, it's a story of recovery. It's not easy to tell that first half of the story. But the second half is about creative process and falling in love and what we can do with our suffering and how we can use that long tail of grief for good. And, you know, how we can tell our inner critic to F off, which has been the secret to my success. So I am, you know, moderate success. So the question was, what is this book and why did I write it? It's not about sex and drugs and rock and roll very much. There's, you know, just a couple of mentions of people along the way, and it really ends before I was known publicly, but it is a yet another fulfilling of a promise that I made. That's why I wrote it. It's about the stories we tell ourselves and what happens when we believe them.
I can't wait to read the book, and I'm sorry I haven't read it, but it really did only get released this month.
So. No, yeah, it's not it. I've had trouble getting a copy from my mother, so it's awkward. But thank you.
Well, we will definitely link to the book when we release this podcast. Thanks, and yeah, Claire's starting a national tour like Monday or something, or in a few days. So it will be in all of your capital cities very soon.
And I'm going to places like Margaret River, I'm going to Hobart, I'm going to Adelaide. And I always get people going, why don't you come to my cities? Well, I am coming. And I've got the most extraordinary hosts, people like Miff Warhurst, Yumi Stein, Sarah Wilson, Constance Hall.
Oh, I love Constance Hall.
She's fabulous.
The best.
Yeah. So it's going to be a really fun night. And the tickets are really cheap. Constance's like, these tickets are $15. Are you sure you shouldn't put the price up? I'm like, nope, we just want to sell it out and get this story out there.
Totally. You are so real and sort of vulnerable in the way that you communicate with
your... I wish I wasn't. Wouldn't it be awesome if you...
I don't wish you were. I feel like that's...
There's a part of me, I don't know if you have this, but there's a part of me that always wishes that, imagine if you just walked into a store and you could buy like a size 10, you could put on some gold earrings and you could put on some high heels and present in the world like you weren't vulnerable. Whereas I don't, my body hasn't really given me that set of choices. So I own it. But anyway,
but
thanks.
That's sort of your superpower at the same time. Like, I don't know, like I'm on your email list, so I get, you know, your emails and then just the way you communicate with your followers on Instagram, you know, it's so real and it's so authentic.
And it's so cool though. I really like these people. Like they've given us our career. They've given us our life and they're just like you and I. And I know that people don't realize this about you too, Luce, but you're, I mean, maybe they do, I don't know, but you're always fucking fabulous in your photos. You're a very real, yeah, you're a very real big-hearted person. And I'm going to, you're looking embarrassed. I'm not going to say more.
Thank you, Claire.
It's true. But don't cut that bit out.
I won't cut it out. But no, I guess what I'm saying is, you know, as people get more and more well-known and more following and all that stuff, often that vulnerability does sort of dissipate and it isn't easy to remain so personal when you're in the public eye. And you've coined the phrase Claire Bear Overshare on your Instagram for the Instagram post, which, you know, can be really personal at times. So I'm just wondering, like, where does that come from? Like, have you always been a person that sort of wears their heart on their sleeve in that way? And on the flip side, is there anything that you really wouldn't share or that you, you know, is anything off limits?
Often what I do is, you heard me take a massive, yet another massive gulp of wine there. So the reason I just sip that wine and also the reason why I am the way I am in the world is, I think, again, it's back to this childhood soup that we swam in. My family's so close and we love each other so much and we drive each other nuts. And the thing that I always knew and the only thing that we kept anchoring back to was life is very mysterious. None of us really know why Ro didn't live. But my mum and dad had a really strong faith that if we just focused on love and on hope, we would find our way through. And again, you know, in their context, that was very much in a faith-based context, but very strong values and understanding that we were actually here to serve each other. So for a long time, I thought that meant I had to stop being such a selfish bastard who wanted to have this career in music. You know, I couldn't work out how it was that I could serve the world. You know, and I thought, I accused myself of all sorts of things, of being overly ambitious and superficial. And, you know, these were all the stories that I would tell myself. And as the years have gone on, it's dawned to me that the best service I can ever do, and the only service I'm really capable of, is of telling the truth about our emotions and about hope and about struggles and what that really looks like. There's an intrinsic relationship I feel most connected and less alone and most belonging and all of those beautiful terms that once again our darling Brené has allowed the language of this time to really talk about in detail, and many others, and she acknowledges that too. But of course, you know, we're in this time now where we've got half a chance of being real, of talking about our mental well-being and understanding that what looks like mental health, I mean, it's so mysterious. We still don't know much about it. We know that there's this curious relationship between the things that we do best and the things that we, the feelings that we have and unresolved things. And I think we'll explore that further in the future. But I speak about that more in the book. Sorry, that might sound really wacko, but it does make more sense.
Yeah, yeah. I totally understand what you're trying to say. That vulnerability and, yeah, Brené Brown, I actually interviewed Kemi, your good friend as well, recently for this podcast. And, yeah, just talking about the power of,
yeah
being honest with yourself and, yeah, being vulnerable is actually really difficult.
Yeah, and it's like I would, like I said before, if I could be another way, if I could have presented, you know, in an Anna Wintour kind of put together way in this world, perhaps I would have. But my body and my emotions and my childhood, you know, I don't really feel that was the wisest option for me. The best thing I can do, as difficult as it can be, is to keep showing up as who I am. And that's my work in the world, I think. In the meantime, trying my best to remind people that it's okay to want to be who you are. It's okay to be who you are. It's okay not to feel like you fit in. And it's really important to me that you keep counting yourself in and sharing yourself in the world, because that really keeps the rest of us going. So I think that is, I can't even quite fucking remember the question after that.
you answered the question, but okay. Is there anything you wouldn't share or that you feel nervous to talk about in a public sense?
Look, between you and I and all of us here, yes, there are some things. Often I will share in retrospect. So, you know, I will share now that we lost our darling friend John this year, and that's been, you know, we really miss him. And I can share that and speak about that with you, although I might do a post on Instagram in honor of him. I couldn't really have talked about that, you know, a couple of months back. So there are things like that, and there are personal things going on all the time. You know, I've got a family member who's unwell. I won't speak about that now because I'm too vulnerable, and it really puts everything at wobbly danger. I don't want to be getting on stage with you beautiful people in my, you know, gorgeous dress, my hair all did, and just burst into tears because I'm talking about things that are close to the heart. I still want to show up with the stories in me that are processed and useful.
Yeah.
You know, and the rest I can sort of say for my therapist. So even though it looks like I tell everything all the time, you know, there are many, many private parts still that aren't that useful to share publicly. So I don't, but I do that with the understanding that we're all like that. Look at us. We're all showing up every day, having our shower, getting out of bed, getting on with it, even though the terms of life are really, they're quite curious when you think about them.
Yeah. Well, we're living in a time where everyone's sharing everything. You know, Instagram's changed so much. And I think, you know, but what you don't often see is the messy stuff and the imperfect stuff. And I think that's what is really so refreshing and important. And that's what you remind us of.
Like I said, if I could do it any other way, I swear to God, I would.
What is next for Claire Bowditch?
So it turns out I really, really like writing. So I still have, and my record company, Island Records and Universal, have been incredibly patient with us. I'm about now 6 or 7 years, you know, behind on my album, and they don't mind because they're, you know, we're buddies for life. They're in it for the long game. So look, I have created an album and I've recorded that album, and I think the next project will really be a music-based project. But for me, and the way my life is at the moment, and this is important to us, what actually suits your life, your family, your dreams, your temperament, my temperament, family, dreams, and life at the moment, I'm probably not going to – I've got 3 kids in high school, and I'm probably going to stay pretty close to home. You know, I'm not going to pursue a massive music career in Europe or in America or anything like that. I'm going to stay home. I'm going to write some more books, and I'm going to keep trying to work out how to be useful, because it makes me feel like I'm doing my job well if I can be useful to people. My greatest hope with this book is that, and it has always been, and it's a really ambitious hope, but that it will allow us to keep having conversations, hopeful conversations, around where is our power? As creative people, as humans in the world, what choices do we have about the stories we tell ourselves? How do we manage this vehicle of a wild creative mind? can we do that well, and can we include people along the way? So I reckon these are the things I'm going to keep working on, probably not just even for the next little while, for the next 5, 10 years, however long I get.
Yeah. Well, I've no doubt you're going to reach so many people with this book, and it's just going to be another huge success, and I can't wait to read it myself. I'm going to ask you one more question.
Sure.
Before we do our quick question segment. So yeah. There's one more long question, then a few more short questions.
I'm so sorry if you are like, you were just here for the quick 20-minute podcast. We didn't do that today, did we?
Oh, no. I'm here for it. What is something you haven't done yet that you would love to do?
Wow, that's a wonderful question.
That's because it would be hard to answer when you've done so many things.
No. All right. So when I was 20, just before I had my nervous breakthrough, I had a terrible breakup, and I was always writing my diary, and I was writing this diary one night, and I decided, F you all, I'm going to London. I'm in my mind, you know, I'm going to London. I'm going to be fabulous. I'm not coming home till I made all my dreams come true. And I wrote a list of what those dreams were. I called it my amazing life list. I want to write a novel, make beautiful music, act in the theatre with inspiring humans, learn a language, run like the wind, help people fit in, travel to every country, make $1 million, smile when my children have babies, make the heart your home, inviting and warm. You know, that was effectively what I wrote. And I remember that because years later I looked back on that list and I'd started to write a little song around it, and that song became Amazing Life. Now, on that list, I've said things like run like the wind, and I've gone to realise I got a knee injury that probably isn't going to allow me
to run like the wind,
but I wouldn't mind hang gliding. All right. So that's what I'm going to say. I've got, you know, these.
What?
I think I would quite love to experience what it feels like to really fly and to feel light in my body. So I'm quite excited about that. I've got no particular plans for it yet, but it's there.
And I did not expect that to be the answer to this question. So we're ending on a note that Claire's next goal in life is to go hand gliding. You heard it here first.
Hand gliding. And I want to write a fiction. I want to write something light and playful. Sometimes it would be just nice to get out from all of the, you know,
I must do
something that means something to, yeah, let's just give something that our girlfriends can read over in the Bahamas.
Amazing.
What do you reckon?
Yeah, whilst hand gliding or after hand gliding.
Can I say, I wouldn't mind like painting my house. I wouldn't mind like fully design filing at one time. Like getting into the, you know, making my home exactly what it is, because it's not been a priority for me. We've got a beautiful, warm home, but I think I want to paint it all matching colours.
Oh, don't be like that. Everyone asks me about the perfect homes on Design Files. My home doesn't look like that. In fact, here's the real secret. No one's home actually looks like that. Every home we shoot has a junk room and has a bathroom that's not worth shooting. And
good.
You know, it's framed carefully.
Thanks, Liz.
That concludes the formal part of the interview, but now we're just going to do the final part, which is quick and hopefully painless.
You ever thought of a TV show? I remember when you first started doing this and I heard your first podcast was with Megan Morton, wasn't it? Was that right?
One of the early ones.
You just leaps and bounds, flying. You're flying.
No. Thank you. That's very kind. Okay, so this is 10 quick questions, sort of one or two word answers, short answers anyway, okay?
Yes.
What time do you set your alarm in the morning?
When I'm writing a book, it's 5 a.m.
I feel like that is so common. Everyone I know that is like a high-achieving human wakes up at 5 or early in the morning, and I just really need to take a leaf out of your book.
When I'm not writing a book, it's my kids donking on my head going, it's 8 o'clock, I got to get to school.
Okay, good. Good to know you've got the two extremes
Absolutely. Operating.
What do you eat for breakfast?
I have oats with fruit and yogurt. Otherwise, I have a coffee with butter in it, which I know sounds weird, but if I'm not hungry, I just love that.
What is a weekly ritual for you, one thing that you do every week?
It's something I do every day is I write. I write in my little bookie book and I have tea and coffee.
Good. What's the most visited website on your computer this week?
The Design Files. It really is.
I don't believe that, but thanks. I'll take it.
It is.
What was the last thing you bought online?
My own book, Audible.
Your own book on Audible. I love that.
And Kindle. I pre-ordered it. I pre-ordered them last night.
Awesome.
Can I say my Audible has my mum's Dutch apple tart recipe at the end. It's amazing. That's all I'm going to say. It's a bonus.
Do you narrate the book?
She narrates that bit. And she also does the language warning at the top, which is really funny. But I narrated the rest. You should have done it for me.
I love this. I never listened to audiobooks.
They're really fun. How do you get to sleep? Like, seriously.
Oh, just because I'm so bloody exhausted by the time I fall into bed. Yeah. Who is someone you admire?
You. It's true. You're I really do. Nice. I do. I also admire a lot of the guests that you've had. You mentioned Kemi Nekpopil before. She's just such an awesome, awesome woman. And Megan, we mentioned before. But someone who I've got a massive girl crush on at the moment and have for many, many years because she's one of my best friends is Jamila Rizvi, because she's sharp and funny and such a lover of, she's such an encourager. There's so many secret people behind the scenes who she's encouraging all the time. The end.
I have never met Jamila. I would love you to connect us. I'd love Done. To meet her one day.
Done.
Where do you go for that perfect date night with Marty on a Wednesday night?
So we usually find a little bistro or a little, I like little Italian hole in the walls place. So
love it. It's 9 p.m. on a weeknight. What are you doing?
I'm unconsciously tired. So quite often I go to sleep very early these days. I could well be prepping for bed at 9. If not, I might be playing a gig. If not, I might be yelling at the kids, for God's sake, can you brush your teeth and just please get into bed? Please get into bed. That's what I might be saying.
When is, well, you sort of answered this just now, but when is your bedtime?
So it can be 9 o'clock. What can also happen in a creative cycle is I stay up till about 2 and it gets a bit messy, but I enjoy that feeling also.
You're a woman of extremes. I like it. And finally, I'm sure there are many things, but if there's just, if you could just name one thing that you are very proud of, what would you say?
I don't know if it's right to say that I'm proud of my children because in a way, I know that sounds weird, they are their own humans, you know, they are making their own lives, but you know, and they know I'm their biggest supporter, but I want for them to be proud of themselves. So I'm going to say that I'm really proud, and this will sound funny, but for so long I was so at war with my body. And when I did become a mum and when I watched my body grow, it was uncomfortable. But that day I gave birth and that baby came out, far out I was proud of that body. I went, I didn't even think about that. It just happened.
Yeah.
You know, there was a little bit of hanky-panky at the start and that's – but we won't go into that. So I'm quite proud of my body for all the years of me being mean to it. It's still been my bestie.
Yeah, that is such a great answer. And it's so very you to end on a note like that. Claire, it's been such a joy to chat to you in our storeroom for an hour. Thank you so much for being on our podcast and best of luck with the National Book Tour. And you can grab Your Own Kind of Girl now from all good bookshops.
I really love you guys and I love you, Luce. And thank you for having me. It's a real honour to be on this Hollywood. Thank you.
Thank you, darling.
You can visit clairebowditch.com, that's clairebowditch.com, for all Claire's news and more info on Your Own Kind of Girl, which is out now in all good bookshops. By the time this episode is released, Claire will be on the tail end of her epic national book tour. You can follow her adventures on Instagram at Claire Bowditch. And just last week, our brilliant columnist Ash Davenport interviewed Claire for a wonderful story for our family column. If you'd like to see Claire's entire family sharing a bathtub, that is well worth checking out. The link will be in our show notes, or otherwise you can click through right now if you're listening on Apple Podcasts. You've been listening to TDF Talks, a fortnightly podcast from The Design Files, Australia's most popular design blog. Please check out our website, thedesignfiles.net, where we post new stories 3 times a day featuring Australian design, art, architecture, and more. Thank you so much for tuning in. And if you've enjoyed today's episode, we'd be so grateful if you would leave us a review on iTunes. Thanks for listening.